call our third case for consideration by the court.
Next case is A230275, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Sydney Philip Manette, Appellant.
Again, good morning. We do appreciate you appearing on our Zoom platform. Both of you have appeared prior. You know the rules, 15 minutes each for your presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please introduce yourself and state who you are speaking on behalf of prior to beginning your argument. Appellant counsel, when you're ready, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Sydney Monette. Mr. Monette has raised 2 issues for this court's consideration, and this morning I'd like to begin by discussing the first. That is, that this court should grant Mr. Monette a new trial because he was prejudiced by the district court's omission of an element from the jury instruction on robbery. There are 2 significant points for this court's consideration of this issue. The first is that the law is clear, and the second is that the facts in this case are highly unusual. In the vast majority of cases charged as robberies, in what we think of in our minds as the prototypical robberies, there is a person present or the property is taken from a person. These are the purse snatchings. These are the a person goes into a gas station with a gun and goes to the cashier and says, give me all the money, right? The almost all of the cases you find, reported cases, appellate cases on robbery, have those sorts of facts. What makes this case unusual and what brings up issue 1 is that the evidence does not show that Mr. Monette took the property from any person or that he was in the presence of any person when he took the property. However, the law is clear.
Can we just talk about that last piece of it, that he wasn't in the presence of a person when he took the property? Because I'm wondering, when is the taking? Is it when he takes it out of the store? Because the video shows there are people there at the time that he takes it out of the store. Is it he took it and put it in his cart and he's walking through the store? Because the video shows that there are other people around him. I'm just wondering, and I understand your argument is when he took it off the shelf, he took it, and then there was no one around, or there's no evidence that there was anyone around. And I'm just wondering what the legal authority is that it's that point in time when he actually initially took it, as opposed to some other point in time when he's taking the property. I'm sorry, that was a long-winded question, but I think—
No, not at all. Not at all. Thonsvan, the case that's cited in our brief, contains 2 really helpful points on this question. One is that the definition of takes is adverse possession. And interestingly, even though Thonsvan is a theft case, Justice Strauss, writing for the court, explicitly says, because theft and robbery are so intertwined, we're telling you the definition of takes in the robbery statute is going to be the same. So even though Thonsvan is a theft case, we know its interpretation of takes to mean adverse possession applies to robbery. The other important thing in Thonsvan is it says adverse possession is a moment in time. It is a single moment. This court actually, in a case called, I believe it would be pronounced Kimmis, which is at 962 Northwest 2nd 487, has sort of defined adverse possession to mean to exercise control to the exclusion of all others. So we know it's a moment in time, and we know it's when the defendant exercises control over an item to the exclusion of all others.
So why wouldn't the moment in time be when he exits the store? Because anybody can put things in their cart and walk around a store, and that's not an adverse possession, because I don't think, because they're still not exercising exclusive dominion over the item. It's when they're exiting the store, right?
So I agree with Your Honor that it is not the moment at which he takes items off the shelf. That is not our position. Our position is there's sort of 2 alternatives for this court that we believe are reasonable. One is when he takes the sort of toiletry items, it was razors and shaving gel, that were already in his cart and puts them in the duffel bag. So the duffel bag is also an item of Walmart merchandise. He didn't bring it in himself. He's adversely possessing at that point because it's clear, and in fact, he does, put it on his back and leave the store. He's not giving it back at that point. It can't become anyone else's property or possession. The other possible moment is when he walks past the cashier and doesn't pay, right? He's adversely possessing it because he's, again, he's taking it with him. He's not letting anyone else have this property. So it's already occurred prior to the moment where he encounters Mr. Anderson. At that point, he's doing the carrying away, right? We know from the robbery statute that that's another sort of pertinent moment for a court's analysis is you have the taking and you have the carrying away.
Can I just pinpoint that moment in time if that's, yes. I mean, I understand your argument. Is it the moment in time when he puts the duffel on his back because then he's trying to exercise control over it? Or is it, I mean, what is the moment in time that you're claiming it is?
Sure. What we wrote in our brief and what I think is a reasonable thing for this court to hold is it's when he puts the items in. The reason being, for what Your Honor just stated, what he then, I don't know that, let me skip backwards for a moment.
You could go back and clarify that because you lost me now. When he puts them into the bag or when he puts the bag on his back, that's what I wasn't clear on.
Sure. So I will say, I think this court could find either of those moments to be the moment of adverse possession. And either way, Mr. Monette still gets a new trial. I understand the thinking that it's perhaps not when he puts them in the bag, but when he puts it on his body that he's adversely possessing the merchandise. I think that's a reasonable position. To my knowledge, in the many video clips from Walmart, I don't believe there's one that captures the moment when he puts the bag on his back, which means the state didn't prove that he was in anyone else's presence when he did that. I hope I've answered Judge Werke's question, and to go back just slightly to Judge Frisch's question, to sort of come at it from a different angle, it's a jury instruction argument. Here, the jury, all they heard, all they knew they had to find was, did Mr. Monette take property from Walmart? The only way I believe this court can affirm and conclude that instruction was correct is to find that Walmart is a person, to engage in statutory interpretation and say the insertion of Walmart into that blank in the jig was proper because Walmart is a person. That has zero support in Minnesota law. Any method of statutory interpretation I have ever seen from this court doesn't suggest that Walmart is a person. Certainly, if this court engages with that holding, I would ask that you publish that opinion because that would be significant. That would be a significant change to the law of robbery that should be published so other courts can rely on it in the future. But here, the jury doesn't hear in the presence at all. They never hear that language. So because that language is omitted from the jury instruction, even if we perhaps disagree a little bit about the moment in time at which Mr. Monette adversely possesses the property, so that's when the taking is, and we're not sure the evidence about who was near him during the taking, jury didn't find that. Jury couldn't possibly have found that because all they hear is took from Walmart. So that instruction is still erroneous. The language from the statute is omitted, and it was prejudicial because you cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard, that there's no reasonable likelihood the outcome would have been different had the jury been properly instructed.
Ms. Yoke-Erickson, I just wanted to explore that a little bit, because if we were to agree with you that the jury instruction was error, your brief is fairly short with respect to analyzing the harmless error consideration of this. Could you just expand on that a bit, please?
Certainly, Your Honor. An additional case that's really helpful on this issue is Watkins, which is a Minnesota Supreme Court case. It's written by Dietzen, and I know he served on both courts, but that's at 840 Northwest 2nd 21. And it's omission of an element from a jury instruction. It was the knowingly element. And the court, even though it's plain error, right? So they're doing substantial rights, and then they're doing the fourth prong of plain error. They talk about what does a court look at to determine whether a defendant was prejudiced by the omission of an element. And what Watkins says is an element is a fact finding to be done by the jury. And when it's omitted, necessarily the jury can't have done that fact finding. And what I think is really helpful in Watkins is the court described the defendant's defense, his trial defense, as unbelievable. I believe it was quoting the state's position, but nonetheless said, even though his defense was unbelievable, his jury didn't make this fact finding. He gets the opportunity to raise his defense to a properly instructed jury. And so it was prejudicial. It harmed him. It affected his substantial rights because he was denied that opportunity to make his defense argument to a properly instructed jury. So here, there's several ways this court can discern prejudice from this record. I certainly would submit on this record, you could conclude a correctly instructed jury would not have found him guilty. Again, that's because the lack of evidence, he certainly didn't take it from a person, right? He took it off a shelf. But there is no evidence in this record that at the moment of taking, he was in anyone else's presence. But that's not the only way you can analyze the prejudice. There's also the sort of Watkins method of prejudice analysis, which is we know this jury didn't make this fact finding. We know because they weren't so instructed. They didn't hear anything about the in the presence language. They only determined whether Mr. Monette took the property from Walmart, and he deserves the opportunity to make his case to a properly instructed jury.
So if the jury were properly instructed on the takes part, right? The district court is not providing an instruction as to what the meaning of takes is, the moment in time that we're talking about. It would be left to the jury to use their common understanding, right?
That's true. I mean, no one argued in this case for an additional jury instruction on the meaning of takes. So yes, the court would have presumably used the JIG, which just says takes.
And so then what do we do with our review there? Because if a jury could reasonably determine based on common understanding of takes, there is evidence in the record that he is carrying this property or taking this property at many points in time. Maybe not the very first point in time in the presence of another, but at other points in time in the presence of another. And isn't it possible for a jury to reasonably conclude from that evidence that that the elements of the robbery are satisfied?
So I have two responses. One is sort of factual and one is legal. As to the facts here, Your Honor, I would disagree that the moments that he's walking in the store with his merchandise, that he's every, say, second, he's doing a taking because he has the property. I don't think that's true, right? What Thonsavant says is it's whenever moment this court determines it is, it's one moment. That's what Thonsavant says. That's what Madden, which is cited in that case, says, which is a case from 1917 that says something like it happens in an instant. So it's one moment. So him walking through the store, he's not doing a taking every time he takes a step. And the sort of the legal side of it is, I think that's a question for a different day in a different case, right? If we want to, in a future case, challenge what takes means and that the evidence was insufficient on takes, perhaps we'll have that case. But here, the questions before this court are, was an element omitted? And did it matter to Mr. Monette's trial? And we would submit that it did for the reasons that I've stated. Just real briefly on issue two, Your Honors, I would just argue to this court that the words, I'm going to shoot you, are not a statement to scare someone in the future. To be clear about what we are and are not arguing, assault two can be a predicate offense of threats of violence. Assault two is on the list of crimes of violence. We are not making any assertion to the contrary. I've thought a lot about it, and I think it's an interesting thought experiment whether or not assault fear can ever be the predicate of a threats of violence. This court doesn't need to engage with that thought experiment. That is not a question that you need to decide because in this case specifically,
what about the force that he used against Alex Anderson as he was exiting Walmart?
The state has never argued, and I don't think that would be sort of aligned with the law that his... I'm sorry, maybe I'm not understanding Your Honor's question. So it was his statement to Mr. Anderson that was alleged as the assault fear. He doesn't touch him. So it's certainly not an assault harm. What the jury is instructed, the only thing the jury is instructed on is the assault fear version of assault. Again, Mr. Anderson can feel fear in the moment. That's an element of terroristic threats. You have to look at the content of the threat and determine whether it meets the elements of the predicate offense. It doesn't here. If Mr. Monette had said, I'm going to scare you tomorrow, hypothetically, that's a threat of an assault fear. I will say, in researching this case, I read a lot of threats of violence cases. I could not find a single one where assault fear was used as a predicate offense for threats of violence. It is almost always someone says, I'm going to kill you, and then it's murder. Or someone says some version of, I'm going to hurt you, right? They use different words for hurt. And then it's a threat of assault two if it's a weapon, assault one if it's an extreme version of bodily violence, bodily harm. I've not found a single case. So that, I think, suggests that this was just a mistake here. The jury was instructed on a predicate offense that the state could not and did not prove. We would ask this court to reverse that conviction. Thank you so much for your time.
We'll hear from Respondent's Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Melton for the state of Minnesota, respondent in this matter. The appellant in this matter attempts to use statutory language in order to argue that robbery of a business cannot occur when case law and common sense within our courts for well over 100 years would say that a person can most certainly rob a business. As the statutes of Minnesota define, whoever, knowing he or she is not entitled to do so, takes personal property from another, commits a robbery if that person uses force or a threat of force to overcome resistance. And so I think the state, as it's argued in its brief, both State v. Shaddle, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and State v. Bowen are very instructive cases. I think Shaddle, particularly where it says under modern statutes defining robbery, the right of ownership or control of stolen goods is immaterial so long as it's not in the robber. And so when you look at the
element, Mr. Melton, is it your position that the district court correctly instructed the jury?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think 100% the court.
And what's the authority that would support the conclusion that a business is a person?
I think it's just the idea that if the court were to look at the first element, that element of the crime is the taking portion. And so when you look at and say that a defendant took personal property, and under the law, under Bowen, personal property includes business property. And so it's logical to say that business property is then taken from a business.
And then are we not giving effect to the language that's chosen by the legislature? The legislature said from a person.
Well, I think the idea that, and again, 100 years of case law that says that a business can be robbed. And I think just common sense, I would go to just the straightforward bank robbery idea. A person walks into a bank, looks to rob that bank, looks to take money from them. And I think defense counsel's argument, the idea that if, let's just say a person came into a bank and was able to get access to that without ever having contact with the person to first gather up that money. And then ultimately, then a security guard or some other person makes contact with that person and says, stop, you can't rob this bank, you can't have this money, that according to defense, that's purely a theft and then a terroristic threats and not a robbery. And that's wholly incorrect and wholly against every argument and every case that's out there where a person has robbed a business, robbed a bank. And the definition and the instruction by the judge was very clear. I would say it was as clear as can be to tell the jury that the first element is purely the taking of that personal property or that business property from the business. And then as the court knows and recognizes in the many cases that defense cited and many different robbery cases, the difference between a theft and a robbery is the use of force. And that's where then you look at the other elements of whether or not use of force to overcome and overpower somebody and to gain their acquiescence to allow that property to be removed is the other elements. And I think appellant takes issue with that somehow the court or that the jury couldn't understand that's the element where a person, let's say a police officer comes in, they're not mutually exclusive. It doesn't have to be that person's property and that person protecting it. It could be the business's property and then the police come in and try to protect that. Or a different person, a security person, or in many cases that the state listed, the defense talked about, it could just be an employee trying to stop them from stealing, whether it's alcohol or jewelry or any other piece of property that belongs to that business. And so the court clearly made that understandable to the jury. The jury did understand that, and the other elements then worked through whether or not force was used against Alex Anderson when it was, and Mr. all of these were proven.
Mr. Melton, counsel for the appellant argues with authority that when the statute says takes property, that means a moment in time. What's your position as to the moment in time at which the defendant or the appellant took the property?
Well, I do think that argument, Your Honor, sort of leads to the absurdity of trying to say that, again, goes away from the common sense idea of a robbery and going into a property, stealing that item or items, trying to take that for your own, and then having a person stop them. I think legally, it can't possibly be that the person has to take that in the presence of a person right away to then say that's the start of a robbery, when clearly they can take that property, desire to take that, and then use force to complete the act, such as we have here.
I appreciate the response, counsel, but my question was, is there a position that the state is taking as to the moment in time at which the appellant took the property?
I think in this case, it's clear that the moment in time was when he makes contact with Alex Anderson at the exit. He's got the property on his back and he's looking to take that away from the business. And so at that moment, that is the factual, in this case, taking of the property and the completion of that first element. That would be the state's position. So I think subject to any other questions in regard to that, I would want to transition the threats of violence argument or the threats of violence charge. I believe that was proper. I think appellant stated that I did not understand the issue. But it wasn't that I didn't understand the issue. I just did not understand appellant counsel's argument. And so if it's a sufficiency of evidence argument that we're talking about, then I think the court has to look at what was the direct evidence or circumstantial evidence. In this case, I would say that there is just direct evidence where the defendant, Mr. Monette, makes the statement, "I'm going to shoot you." That is direct evidence of the mens rea that's happening and his intent to cause fear of violence. It's a threat of violence. That's what the person is ultimately afraid of. And then the actus reus is the reaching down and acting as if you have a gun and that you're going to pull that out. And again, you're causing fear of that person either seeing the gun, having the gun brandished at them, the potential for that gun to be shot at them. Any and all of those things are things that a person be afraid of. Certainly fear that you could get shot, could get injured, or ultimately killed. But that doesn't mean, if the ultimate thing is death, that does not mean that you always have to charge murder as the predicate. And so I think reading the arguments from there, I think at the end of the day, a sufficiency of the evidence, if you give due regard to the evidence that showed the mens rea, the actus rea, that due regard to presumption of innocence and the prosecution's burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury certainly could reasonably have found guilt and did in this case. And that's really the end of the argument, such as appellant counsel stated that under 609-1095 and under the statute itself, a crime of violence or a violent crime is defined as 609.222. And that's really the end of it. It should be. And so I was confused by the idea that the argument then seemed to, devolve into or go into a statutory construction type argument of whether or not fear could be a predicate crime. It certainly can. The statute allows it. It is to say that there's never been one that's done. Well, maybe nobody else did it right. I'll say I think I did it right, did the correct charge, and clearly the jury found that as well. And there's nothing within the statute, nothing within any other rules of criminal procedure, nothing within the instructions to the jury that would say otherwise. And so it is proper. It is correct. Clearly, you could find fear, and they did. And so, again, we would ask the court to uphold that finding as well and that criminal conviction. Subject to any other questions, Your Honor, that's all I would have for the court.
It's not, Mr. Melton. Thank you for your argument. We'll turn back to you, Ms. Janjerickson, for any rebuttal you may have.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're certainly not suggesting you can't rob a business. Of course you can. Every single one of the cases cited by respondent involve a taking from a person's body or with the classic cashier present. This case doesn't touch those. Those will still be robberies. But the facts in this case are highly unusual because there was no taking from a human being's body and the state can't prove there was anyone present. I was the lawyer on Bowen. I'm very familiar with it. Bowen was about a different element. Bowen interpreted the phrase.
What about Alex, Mr. Anderson, the person that was asking him for the receipt when he made the threat? I mean, he's a person.
The taking was not done in his presence. And so all the authority says, and again, I don't think
Mr. Melton says that that's when the taking occurred.
Mr. Melton has no authority for that proposition. So Thon Savant, everything that this court and the Supreme Court has ever said is it's one moment in time and it happens when the person exercises control over the property to the exclusion of all others. That happens way before he encounters Mr. Anderson. He's already been walking around with the bag on his back at that point. And again, it's one moment in time. It's not continuing because that's the carrying away. The biggest problem with respondents' interpretation, which would have this court hold that Walmart is a person, is that person is used several other times in the robbery statute. And if Walmart means person once, it necessarily has to mean person again. So uses force against any person to overcome the person's acquiescence. So now we'd have a robbery statute where there's no human involved, because apparently you could use force against Walmart to overcome Walmart's resistance to the carrying away of property. Courts hardly ever find statutory interpretations absurd. That is borderline absurd. Robbery as a common law crime was a person crime. You took something from a human being's body and you used force against that person. The legislature has understandably broadened the crime since then. They have the power to do so. If Mr. Melton wants you to be able to rob a Walmart when nobody is present, say in the middle of the night when there's no human there, he should go to the legislature and ask them to change the law. On threats of fear, I think there's some confusion about the fear. So of course, Mr. Anderson felt fear, but that is an element of terroristic threats. There's always got to be intent to cause fear or reckless risk of causing fear. The confusion is that the statement itself, the words, if it's an assault fear, doing that would have to cause Mr. Anderson fear. So the state would have had to prove to the jury that if Mr. Monette came back tomorrow and followed through, shot him, that he would be shooting him with the specific intent to cause Mr. Anderson to feel fear. And that's where it breaks down. To be clear, if the state had charged and it was submitted to the jury as threats of violence against Alex Anderson with the predicate offense of assault harm, we wouldn't be here. He clearly did that. He did not, by his words, "I'm going to shoot you," threaten in the future to scare Mr. Anderson. He's scaring him in the present, no doubt. That's why it's charged as a terroristic threat, and it can be and it should be. But when the state chooses a predicate, we know based on a lot of cases that the district court has to instruct on the specific predicate offense and its elements, because we have to make sure that the words were a threat to do that crime. Mr. Monette arguably threatened to commit an assault harm. A shooting is an assault harm. A shooting is not done with a specific intent to scare someone. They simply didn't prove the case the way it was submitted to the jury, and we would ask that you reverse that conviction. Mr. Monette should be granted a new trial on the robbery offense. The district court omitted an element when it said, you only have to find, jury, that he took property from Walmart. No court has ever held that Walmart is a person or that with no person present, a robbery can be committed. If this court chooses to so hold today, I would ask that you publish that opinion because that would be a massive change in the law. Not in the alternative, but we would additionally ask if this court reverse Mr. Monette's threats of violence conviction. Thank you so much.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well argued. The case is submitted. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. That does conclude our oral argument calendar. Court will be in recess pending our deliberations. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.